Now, reality, what is it? In medieval times, the old spiritual cosmos was thought to be the primary reality, the true place of existence, with our physical reality almost an afterthought. Now, in the late 20th century, we're confronted with new space, particularly cyberspace, the name given to that international network of computers which allow us all to, well, not me, because I'm not into it yet, but allows the rest of you to communicate across time, geographical distance, and as well, we're told, does not discriminate against race, gender, or creed, because in cyberspace or virtual reality, it is ultimately an imaginative space. Science writer and commentator Margaret Wertheim has written a new book exploring these connections, and she's here in the Sydney studio to guide me through this relationship between spiritual space and cyberspace. The book, the newie, The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space from Dante to the Internet, published by Doubleday, and a very fine hardcover with a photograph of Margaret up the back looking rather sad, and a lovely painting on the front of
an angel.
Turn your microphone on, that'll help. An angel who bears an uncanny resemblance to you, Margaret. This is a happy accident.
You're the first person to have pointed that out, Philip, and I'm flattered.
See, on the back you're looking sort of secular. There on the front
yes,
you're looking...
Oh, I see. Yes.
You're looking spiritual. Now, the book investigates a link between spiritual space and cyberspace. Would you be very kind to a doddery old presenter and tell me what that's all about?
Well, basically, the main theme of the book is how... In the Middle Ages, people saw themselves embedded in both physical space and spiritual space. But with the rise of modern science, we came to see ourselves embedded purely in physical space, and therefore we've come to see ourselves purely as physical beings. And I think, although that's, if you like, the official world picture of our culture, that many people simply haven't really accepted that, and they've really been looking for a home, if you like, for this immaterial self, soul, spirit, whatever word you want to use.
And now those yearnings can be found in cyberspace.
Well, now one of the places that they are looking for a home for this spirit or soul is in cyberspace. And if you look in America, almost all the major gurus of cyberspace have basically made claims to this effect, that it will be some new home for the soul.
Of course, it's been argued for many years that while God doesn't exist, he or she is coming into existence as a result of the great expansion of consciousness. Is this one of the propositions you'd put forward?
Well, that's kind of an idea that many people have linked with the Jesuit philosopher Teilhard de Chardin, the notion that sort of there will be this eventual evolution of a noosphere, this realm of knowing. And many of the cyber gurus have actually suggested that cyberspace is in fact the realisation of Chardin's noosphere.
That's what they think. What do you think?
Think that's
a bit over the top?
I do actually think that's a lot over the top, Philip. I mean, I don't actually think that cyberspace is going to be what Chardin had in mind in the noosphere, although I do think there is a very real sense in which it is genuinely a new space of being, and that actually does interest me.
I hate to think that Bill Gates replaces the pearly gates, though.
Yeah.
Now, what about this idea, which we're often discussed on the program, in fact, quite recently, where... cyberspace offers a sort of eternal life because you could download your consciousness onto a floppy or something.
Yes, well, there are all these people seriously putting forward the notion that in the not-too-distant future we will be able to download our minds into cyberspace and therefore live forever in digital heaven, or what they think of as digital heaven. And, you know, very serious scientists are putting forward these views.
You shocked me by telling me off-air that Daniel Dennett...
I
thought he was one of my mob, a sort of really hardline materialist.
I did too. I was shocked, but I interviewed him recently, and he actually went on to suggest of his own volition that this was going to be possible soon. And he made the association that I make in the book that, in fact, this was in many ways could be seen as a re-envisionment in electronic terms of the Christian soul. This notion that there is, that the real you is not the matter of your body, but some immaterial, immortal essence that can somehow transcend the body and live forever.
Okay, the loss of celestial space, now the new space for yearning, cyberspace. You trace a history of these spaces from the Middle Ages. What are the principal markers along this timeline?
Well, I think that the first really major marker that happens is when in the late 17th century, when we effectively abandon the medieval scheme of physical space and spiritual space and see ourselves embedded purely in physical space. And one of the reasons that this can happen, and I think it's a fundamental marker in our history, is that for the medievals, their physical universe was quintessentially finite. And with the rise of modern science, particularly with the Newtonian world picture, we came to see physical space as being infinite. And once you had physical space being infinite, there was literally no room left to put spiritual space. And then...
What do you mean? Because it was just blown away by the winds of eternity? Or...
Well, you see, for the medievals, there was this very profound reason that they could envision that there was plenty of space for spiritual space because their physical universe was finite. They did believe the Earth was at the centre of this small... Yeah. Spherical cosmos, and although technically speaking physical space or space ended at the outermost sphere of the cosmos, metaphorically they could imagine there was plenty of room left for God beyond that physical universe. And when you see drawings of the medieval cosmos, beyond the outermost sphere of the universe proper is the empyrean heaven of God. But once you imagine that physical space extends for infinity, there's, if you like, no room left for God or the spirit to be. And so it's become a very great problem in the West ever since. If you want to believe in God and a realm of spirit, where is it? Now, the move that Newton tried, and he was going on a tradition of this, was to say that the space itself is associated with God, that God becomes the medium, space becomes the medium for God's expression and action.
When I was a child, the only way I could imagine God, and as you know, I've never sort of nailed my colours to that particular mask, but as a child it just seemed to me that everything was God, you know, that infinite space and infinite time, you could call that God if you wished as a sort of shorthand.
Yes. And that's effectively what Newton did. But, of course, Newton was also very aware, as a really serious Christian and one who, you know, spent years on his own theological ramblings, that that had to be associated with the God of redemption. And that's the problem, that throughout history, throughout scientific history, and you see it happening now with people trying to spiritualize modern visions of multidimensional hyperspace, it's all very well to say, well, God is somehow associated with that multidimensional space. But the question you have to answer is, well, how does that relate to the God of Christian redemption, the God of salvation?
Well, you must bump into scientifically literate theologians from time to
yes,
time. There must
lots.
Be a couple of them.
There are quite a few.
How do they cope with wormholes, black holes, white holes? Are they able to appropriate them, to fit them into some theological scheme?
Well, most serious theologians aren't even interested in trying to do that. I mean, they see that as an artifact of the pure science, and they don't really see it as having particular theological implications. What you do see people doing is some theologians are definitely still trying to say that space is the medium of God's action and God's all-pervasiveness, and that is a similar move that was going on in the 16th and 17th centuries. But the real question that theologians understand is that in some sense, the God of Christian theology actually must exist in some sense transcending physical space.
Now, I've caught you out in angelic form on the front cover of the book, so I've got to ask you this, and I think it's fair. Yeah. What is your own theology?
Well, this is something I think about a lot, Philip. I don't consider myself a theist in the sense that I don't believe in a transcendent God, but I do consider myself religious in the sense that I actually believe that the whole of the universe itself is what is sacred. I mean, in a way, I think I identify more really with animism, that I believe that in some sense the whole world is itself ensouled.
Animism, pantheism, any of those isms are more are closer to you than...
Well, animism in particular, because yeah. I like the idea... I mean, I do actually believe in some sense the trees and rocks have their own spirits, which is not to say that I believe that they're sort of ontologically separate, but I do believe in some sense that it is the world that is the grounding of sacrality, and of course that's...
Well, given that belief, that yearning in you, how do you deal with the terrible outcome promised to us by the second law of thermodynamics?
Well,
I mean, down the track, just silence, isn't it?
It's just silence. Yes. Well, I must say, it doesn't really bother me too much what's going to happen in maybe 100 billion years, because
I get full of anxiety about it.
Except
I wake up at night thinking, what's going to happen in 1,000 billion years?
My real worry, Philip, is what's going to happen in the next 200. I mean, if the human race manages to survive that long, I think we could just sort of cheer long and loud.
Mm.
I mean... I think it's highly dubious that we're going to survive the next millennium, let alone the next billion years.
Margaret, is this an evangelical book that you've written?
I hope not, Philip. No, I don't see it.
That's not an insult.
No. I realise that, but no, I don't want it to be an evangelical book at all. What I really want it to be a book about is this: that I want it to hopefully make people think for themselves about this notion that, with the age of modern science, that we have come to be obsessed with the notion that the physical world is the totality of reality. And I think that's a profoundly problematic, for me, not so much in a spiritual sense, but in a psychological sense, because I do believe that Descartes is in some sense right, that I am first and foremost a thinking being, that myself, my psyche, is the primary reality. And
remember,
I want
Pascal saying, man is but a reed, but we are a thinking reed.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And what I would like the book to do is to really sort of encourage people to think more for themselves about challenging pure materialism as a philosophy.
I'd love to get you on one night with Richard Dawkins. We could have a real brawl, couldn't we?
Well,
but if you've got a sort of a confession out of Dennett, who knows what would happen with Dawkins? Now, I understand, and I'm delighted to learn this, that you were recently appointed a research associate to the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
Yes.
This is very good, Margaret.
It was a very nice thing.
What do you do for them?
Well, I don't really have to actually do anything. I mean, what it effectively means is because Niles Eldridge, who is one of their primary researchers, and he's the person who, with Stephen Jay Gould, thought up the theory of punctuated evolution.
Yeah.
Niles and I have worked together, particularly giving talks on the subject of science and religion, and it was Niles who invited me to be a research associate there. It doesn't actually have any formal duties, it just means...
Gives you another lectern, though, doesn't it?
Yes, and I will, in fact, be giving a talk there in April about the book, which is a great honour.
Does he agree with Gould on spiritual issues? Are they as one?
No, I think that actually Niles himself is now writing books on this subject. In fact, Gould's next book is on the subject of science and religion.
But Gould is a fellow sceptic. I'm on a committee with him, and he's a passionate sceptic on these matters.
Yes. Well, although somebody told me recently that he's been going around saying he believes in God, I haven't found out whether that is true or not. But Gould's basic attitude is that science and religion are non-intersecting sets, and so that it's fine to have both, but they just simply don't have anything to do with each other. Niles has a more sophisticated understanding that that's just not true, that religion actually does make claims that impinge upon scientific territory and vice versa.
Sorry to interrupt, I'm just looking at the time and it's rushing away. If we've got Gladys listening to the program who'd like to express their yearnings in cyberspace, are there places they can go? I don't want you to sort of rattle off addresses, but is this debate that you're describing in your book taking place in cyberspace now? In other words, are there large numbers of people who are trying to come to some sort of understanding, some common ground between science and religion?
There is actually quite a lot of discussions. Well, the net is full of discussions about religion, and there are a growing number of sites, yes, that are talking about science and religion. If anyone's actually interested in that, the main one is what's called the Meta List, M-E-T-A List. Also, you can go to a big website set up by the Counterbalance Foundation. That's www.counterbalance.org. So there is, in fact, a growing number of sites devoted specifically to discussing science and religion, as there is a huge number of books coming out and journals and conferences. I mean, it's this
nonetheless,
huge
I like to think
movement.
Of you as the Joan of Arc of the movement. I hope you don't get burnt in a public place. Margaret, lovely to talk to you. The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space from Dante to the Internet. And it is, of course, by the author of Pythagoras's Trousers, now in paperback.